Welcome to Losing a Child, Always Andy's Mom. On this podcast, we journey through the devastating experience of the death of a child. Grief is seldom discussed openly in our culture, and the death of a child makes people feel even more uncomfortable. We approach the topic openly and honestly, speaking to people who have lost loved ones and experts who help care for them. Whether you are a parent experiencing loss or someone who wants to support another going through this tragedy, this podcast strives to offer hope and help.
Welcome to episode 235 of Losing a Child, Always Andy's Mom. I'm Marcy Larson, Andy's mom. Today, I am delighted to introduce you to Alicia, Jake's mom. Now, I'm not going to go into a big introduction here, but know that you will just love her. I do want to take a quick opportunity, though, to talk about the upcoming live stream that will be happening this Monday, March 18th at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. So again, we're going to be talking about how in grief you can feel that everything is spinning out of control. So the part two question, because I gave you part one, some questions last week. So the questions this week are, have you found yourself regaining a little bit of that control? And if you have, was that a conscious effort or did it happen organically? So think about those. If you want to email me the answers, you can do that at marcy@andysmom.com, or you can look for those questions to be posted on Facebook or Instagram on the Always Andy's Mom accounts. So again, I hope to have many of you listening in. And for now, just sit back and listen to Alicia, Jake's mom. Thank you so much for agreeing to come on the Always Andy's Mom podcast today.
Thank you for having me. I'm pretty excited. I love talking about Jake.
So do you want to start out by just telling us all about your son, Jake?
Yeah. So my pregnancy with Jake was normal.
Was he first baby for you?
He was our first and only baby. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And that was interesting because I was 24, 25, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah, anyway. No, sorry, I was 30. Oh my God.
You were 30! You felt young.
In Isaac. Anyway, I'm also a nurse and I'm a very analytical person. So I looked at my pregnancy with him in a very scientific way. I was just very interested about what was, but yeah, so it wasn't the touchy feely kind of, it was more like, I wonder how big he is now. I wonder. Yeah. and even when he was born.
I totally get that. As a doctor, oh my gosh. Yeah. I've told this story before how I got my ultrasound, my prenatal ultrasound, and they're going through all the body parts. And I asked, most people would ask, is it a boy or a girl? I asked if the diaphragm was intact. That's just weird. Yeah. You don't ask that. The ultrasound tech looked at me and said, what are you? And I said, I'm a pediatric resident. She said, okay, that explains a lot. So I get you. No one thinks about the diaphragm being intact unless you're in the medical field and you've seen kids with congenital diaphragmatic hernias, right? Yes. That's weird.
Yeah.
So I'm with you. With you, 30-year-old nurse. Yeah.
So the poor guy was kind of under a microscope. Really, all the time. I was just always observing everything.
Yeah.
Yeah. So good and bad.
Right.
Interesting. I didn't even put that together until now. But when he was born, and as he got to the place where he was starting to focus his eyes more, he was an observer right from the start. Yeah. He was very laid back. Watching everything and who knows what all he was taking in and learning. I would have loved to get into his brain, but
I love babies like that. There are certain babies that just are like that. I see them in the office and they just look curious and observant, and you would think you can't tell that, but you can. You really can see it in certain kids.
And kind of so cool. Old soul, right from the start. Just an old soul. He was his whole life. Yeah. So he developed normally. He had, he held his head up, he did all the things, and he did start having some minor delays in his milestones. He always met them, but it was at the later end. So he would sit up, he would, you know, he learned to turn over. But then he just wasn't doing like the babbling, and he wasn't doing the like pulling himself up, that kind of a thing. Okay. So it's just kind of, you know, paying attention. But I also know in the back of my head, first time baby, I'm paranoid about everything. Like,
right.
Or I should say first time mother. And I'm a nurse, so I'm like, am I hypervigilant? Am I,
right. No? You know too much, right? Yeah. You know too much.
Am I just worried about nothing? Yeah. And so kind of asked around. I worked with some doctors, and I just kind of, you know, asked and casually. And they're like, well, you know, he's a boy. So boys take time to, sometimes they're a little later with their development. Mm-hmm. So I made a decision in my head that once he turned 18 months, if he wasn't walking, that's when I was going to like pursue intervention. Mm-hmm. Because like, okay, that's the outside of normal. And, you know, of course you do a lot of reading. And a lot of So, and I mean, they were at his follow-up checkups, like with public health, they knew he was missing some milestones, but yeah, there's just really no big alarm bells. The one thing I noticed, that it was such an interesting thing to notice, because it's like the tiniest thing, but he didn't have a pinch or grasp. That was one of the milestones he missed. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't like, I had a friend who had a baby a month or so older, and he was pushing buttons on toys and manipulating. Yeah. And Jake just wasn't doing that. Yeah. So, and then, and of course, he was under my microscope. Yeah. So we ended up taking him to a pediatrician. We were living in northern Manitoba at the time. And so we just had locums coming.
Yeah. And not anyone pediatric trained, probably just general.
We had a nurse practitioner, a pediatric nurse practitioner. And so she's who kind of, and I knew her, so she's kind of who facilitated, you know, making sure we got in with somebody. Mm-hmm. So the first thing they did after they assessed him was sent for him for an MRI and a bunch of blood work. And so the MRI was kind of the significant thing for us. It got called into the nurse practitioner's office. She would be the one who followed up when the locums weren't there. And she let us know, she said, I got his MRI back. We have news and it's not good. And she said, you'll need to expect that Jake's going to have needs for the rest of his life, like extra needs, something like that.
Okay.
Which was actually, I love the way she worded it, because it wasn't like, he's not going to do this, he's not going to do that. It was, he's going to have extra needs for the rest of his life.
Right. That was a really nice way to word it, actually.
He asked me to call my husband. So I called him and, you know, let him know, which I can't even remember the rest of that day. I don't know. But yeah, so all of a sudden we just have this really vague, what they found in the MRI is he had a thin corpus callosum, so the part that joins the two parts, the two sides of the brain, and he had decreased white matter. Okay. So yeah, and so the, as we kind of, you know, got to know the condition more, we learned like the white matter, you know, that's the part that sort of insulates the nerves and helps the messages get from here down to everything else. So
right. But it was very nonspecific. That's a very nonspecific kind of thing to not know exactly. And that's another reason why she would have said he's going to have needs, because you don't really know what that all means, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And the thin corpus callosum can be really have profound effects. And there are other people that have that as an incidental finding on an MRI, and they've lived a perfectly normal life. So that MRI was telling and then yet not really, because it really didn't give you huge answers, just there will be
needs. It felt very vague. So there's probably maybe eight or so differential diagnoses on the report.
Yeah,
but one of the differential diagnoses was sialic acid storage disease. I can't remember, they've changed the way they word it in the literature over the years, so that might not have been the way, but that was the thing. One of the things. And so then we got sent to our, you know, bigger, our pediatric hospital in Manitoba, which is in Winnipeg. And we saw a metabolic specialist. He was a metabolic/genetic specialist and a neurologist. I think that was kind of it for his team at the beginning. Anyway, they did a bunch of more testing. They asked us a bunch of questions. And there was a lot of like, are you sure he lifted his head at the right milestone, like did he act? And so I started second guessing, and I go back to my books and like baby books or whatever I journaled in, and he did that. Are you sure he sat up on like within the, like they asked about all the milestones, And part of it is one of the characteristics of sialic acid disease, and I'll call it sialic disease. That's one of the kind of layman's terms or slangs that they'll use, because one of the characteristics is they actually develop all their milestones at a normal interval for the first few months of their life. Uh-huh. And then about 6 to 18 months, you start to see the missing milestones. So, and he was a little surprised that they had sialic acid disease as a differential diagnosis on the MRI.
Yes.
So what happened was, and it was all found, his actual final diagnosis was found by fluke.
Because it's really, really rare. It's extremely rare. And what's funny is, even before we started recording, one of the first questions I asked you is, are you of Swedish or Finnish descent? Because most of the people that have this disease are from Sweden or Finland. And you said, no, I'm not. And everyone asked me that question. So that's another reason why someone in Manitoba would not jump to your head at all. Yeah. I mean, I had to look it up. This is certainly not something I'm familiar with at all. Yeah. So.
And the only reason they actually found it as a differential diagnosis was the neurologist he said, I was up in the middle of the night one night, and I guess he must have been thinking about one of his patients. And he was like, I wonder, he read a journal and he read about sialic acid disease. And I was like, I wonder if it's that. So he had the radiologist look at her MRI for sialic acid disease, and she didn't have it. Right. But now the radiologists know what sialic acid disease is. It's on their radar, even though it's very, very rare. And so when Jake's MRI came along, they happened to, hey, that looks like sialic acid disease. It was
because they were looking for it in somebody else.
Yes.
Crazy. That's crazy.
Yeah. So his diagnosis was a fluke. Because initially they diagnosed him with global developmental delay.
Yeah. Right. Which you would have been from the beginning. So that's why they kept questioning you, are you sure? Are you sure? Are you sure? Because those things would have been probably from birth, more delays, as opposed to being more normal at the beginning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because they were really wondering if there was like a leukodystrophy, and a lot of that. Yeah. Is often there's no, they don't meet the milestone at all.
Kind of at all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So now it was a little agonizing because we had these differential diagnoses to kind of look through on the internet. So dangerous.
Yeah.
And we were gravitating towards that one because that's the one that kind of he met most of the criteria for like diagnosis. Yeah. And that was tough because there is a range of, severities. And so at the time he was probably around, 18 months to 2 years when we were doing this. And like you read about some versions of it, they die in infancy. So there's the severe sialic. So you're just all of a sudden you're grieving like this. Mm-hmm. Is he going to die soon? Like, are we? And so I had to actually stop reading the research. The other thing is the research, because it's so, so rare, like just there's maybe a couple hundred in the world.
Yeah. I mean, what I was reading was there were a few dozen cases of the infant severity that they die in infancy, and they estimated about 150 cases of the ones that live on into adulthood, and then there are some that are in the middle, and they didn't even give a number for the ones in the middle. So it's like you can have these three different – anyway, it would be hard. It would be really hard.
So the things I fixated on at first were – with the death part, but then also usually they say it's neurodegenerative. So then they say usually the decline or the degeneration happens in like the third decade of life. So I was picturing like, and so I was sad about that. Very, very sad. I had to do a lot of grieving. Kind of, it took me a while to get around to that finally, but I read somewhere, some people live with until like into their 70s.
Wow.
And I've gone back and read and realized there are some who die earlier, like you said, category. But I completely skipped over. I just, for some reason, and it depends on where we were at, probably in our diagnosis journey, in terms of what context I was looking at it in. But so I made a decision then, I'm not going to worry about the future. We don't know what that is going to look like. We're just going to live right now. We're going to make the best of what we have right now. And we're going to try really hard not to focus on that looming future that we might, we'll eventually have. So I really just pushed it way in the background. But I was fixated on that some will live into their 70s. And if they live into their 70s, it's usually they die from like aspiration pneumonia, or, you know, choking or something. So then we got the genetics back, and it confirmed he had a urine test and a tissue biopsy and then the genetic test. And that's all confirmed the diagnosis.
Okay.
And so we found out I have, or we actually don't remember who has what, but my husband and I both carry the gene. It's autoreceptive. Mm-hmm. We both carry it, and then we have 25% chance of passing it to our child. So he was a 25%. So one of us has a French mutation, and one of us, I think, has the Finnish mutation. And
oh, interesting.
Yeah, and we don't know where it came from. Like, there's no, we can't go back. And,
yeah,
and one of them was less severe. And mutations, and one of the mutations was more severe. And so I'm very a very optimistic person. So I was like, okay, well, he's not as severe.
Well, and I think you would be, I mean, I know if it was me.
Yeah.
And with this diagnosis came at 18 months, you'd think, okay, well, if it was the really, really bad thing, he'd probably already be gone.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So let's just go the other way. Right? Yeah. I mean, I think that's where my head would have gone. So I'm sure that's where your head went too, because he was kind of outside of the range that the most severe kids have.
And in my eyes, like, because I'm his mom, he was doing amazing. He was like, even though he was delayed in his milestones, like, oh, he's quite mild. Like he's doing some amazing things. So he can't have intermediate.
right.
So, yeah, I mean, and he was trying to learn. He was crawling and he was trying to learn to walk. And, you know, so we got the diagnosis took probably a good year. So I think he was 2.5 by the time we got the diagnosis. It was pretty anticlimactic because we had already figured that's probably what it was.
Yeah.
Because, of you know, he matched so many of the clinical signs. And then also there's no treatment for it. So, like, what good does this do us? Great label. We have a diagnosis, but it doesn't really help us.
Yeah.
Or Jake. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that's his diagnosis story. But I really want to talk about like who he was.
Right. Me too.
So the cool thing about, it's partly a characteristic of sialic acid disease, but it's also just a characteristic of Jake, but he loved people. Like loved people. So a couple of the things, like he learned to say a few words through his life. And one of his first words was hi. And everybody got hi. Hi. I'm pretty sure he learned hi before he learned mom.
I love that.
Yeah, he did eventually learn mom. But he also then learned to shake hands. And so constant Jake going around shaking hands. And then it would evolve to he would take someone else's hand. He loved connecting people. Then he'd take this person's hand, this person's hand, and he would force them to shake hands. Like he just wanted everybody to love each other, I guess.
Oh, love that.
Yeah. I mean, and I feel bad because as his parents, like it was very repetitive and constant. We're like, KJ, you said hi. Like we're done saying hi. You know, like trying to set those boundaries, but it was also really cute at the same time. But I think now that I look back and know a lot more, I think he was just really working on his skills and like, what if I do it this way? What if I do it that way?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, but I didn't see the subtleties of it. But we always joke that we lived in a town at that time called Mitchell. And so we always joke that Jake was the mayor of Mitchell.
Yeah, because he's shaking everybody's hand and
kissing
the connector.
he just loved. And then also it was really interesting because as much as he loved people, he also was really good at setting boundaries. And all of a sudden, if it was evening and we were visiting somewhere, he got to a place where he learned to walk. He'd walk over, grab his hat, put it on, and bye! Like, he was done. Or if people were at our house, he would say bye and start pushing them out the door.
It is time for you to go home now.
It's time for you to go. So his personality shone through, even though he didn't have a lot of verbal words. He ended up having probably like, I don't know, 20 or like 20 to 50 verbal words. Like a lot of them were unintelligible. And again, looking back, especially when we worked with a speech therapist, she could hear words we couldn't.
Yeah.
And I'm sure if I went back, I could hear, I would probably be able to hear them now because I have more just context, maturity, whatever it is. He was talking to us all the time, but I had no idea. He also learned sign language, which was a bit of a fluke. Baby signing was really popular at the time. And so we had these signing time videos he'd watch, and all of a sudden we're like, oh my gosh, we broke our kid. He wouldn't do anything except, and he was probably 2.5, three and a half, obsessively watching these videos over and over and over. But we were watching them in the background, so we were learning it unconsciously. And then we started using some signs with him. And I think his first sign was hat and jacket, because he loved going outside. So we talked about hat and jacket, and he'd want to go outside. So then we'd react to it and take him outside.
Nice.
Yeah. So he probably in the end developed or learned probably at least 100 signs or so.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah.
So he really could communicate with you.
It was hard. A lot of the signs like were zoo animals and stuff. So they were, so there was a lot of stuff he still couldn't tell us.
Sure.
And I'll be honest, I think I was so focused on him needing words and signs that I really didn't see the other communication he was trying to have with me. I was, he would be communicating with me like non-verbally, and I'd miss so much of what he was saying. I was just so focused on the milestones. I got really focused on the milestone, even the walking. Like, we really pushed him hard to walk. We got him with occupational therapy. We ended up getting him a walker. So he, I think it was 4 when he learned to walk with his walker. It was quite cute.
Oh, I'm sure.
Yeah. And then somewhere in there, and I can't remember what age he was, but maybe 6 or 7, he just walked away from his walker and started walking. And really unbalanced, fell a lot, like, it's a heart attack. Because the taller you are, the harder you fall.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
We were really lucky. Another fluke thing I feel like happened, because I was so desperate to communicate. I wanted to communicate with Jake with those like communication boards.
Sure.
So I went to a workshop that was put on by a speech language pathologist, because I feel like the traditional speech language therapy stuff just wasn't working. We weren't getting anywhere. So I went to this workshop to learn how to make these communication boards. And the lady in the workshop was like, I think you should meet this. You should apply to be in this program. It's from what your son sounds like, this would be right up for Allie. And the program she did was called RDI. It stands for Relationship Development Intervention.
Okay.
And so she had on the side kind of gotten trained herself. She, did extra training with this psychologist couple in the States who do this therapy. And what it is she trains, she's a consultant. She works with the parents to teach them to work with their child. So she doesn't work directly with the child. And it was probably the biggest gift we ever got, because she, again, helped so hyper-focused. It's like I was so focused on his milestones, I wasn't really developing a relationship with him.
Okay.
I just wasn't seeing who Kim. And she would, first off, she did a little session on grief with us.
Okay.
And she taught us about grief. And she taught us about fight, flight, or freeze. She taught us about that, stress cycle. And she said often, like, the therapies actually develop more for autism, but it works for, she had a lot of kids in her practice, like Jake, and she said it works really well for them. A lot of it is just slowing down, taking her, because she said all the parents I meet are in crisis, pretty much, and they don't know it, which I think is very typical of parents who have a child with a disability. So it was the first, because I was always trying to look on the bright side. I was always trying to, but at least he's this, at least this.
Yeah.
Which now I know after grieving his death, like, at least is a very yucky term. Sometimes you just got to say, actually, it really sucks. This is really hard. This isn't the future I imagined.
Yeah.
And so we grew a lot, both my husband and I. We sort of talked about, like, when he was born, we had this, it's like your child's life flashes before your eyes. Even if you're not expecting them, say, to go to university or be the, prime minister or president, or you just have these, you don't realize you're doing it until it goes away. And then when that diagnosis came, like one of the things I'll never forget my husband saying is, I pictured my son at 9 years old in the playground running and playing tag with his friends, and he's never going to do that.
Yeah.
So it's just those little things. Yeah.
Yeah.
You
The
don't.
little things that you grieve that you don't
Yeah.
realize.
Yeah. And because you're not allowing yourself to acknowledge it, you just keep stuffing it down. And then it comes out in your parenting, and it comes out in anger, and it comes out in frustration, and it comes out in avoidance, or whatever it is.
Yeah.
So yeah, it was a real big gift, I think, that he was probably 5 or 6 when we entered that program. And it was a 4-year program. And what she taught me was empathy, which is interesting because I'm a nurse. I think I do a great job in my job with empathy. But when it comes to your family, where it's your soft place to fall, I think you just, you don't always have it. The famous thing about having a healthcare provider as a parent is good luck to you if you're sick.
Right. Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. So, yeah. So and then there's things about attachment and all of that, but she just really, really helped me get to a place where I had more compassion. And it was more about our relationship, and I stopped getting so obsessed about the milestones and the analyzing the science part of it all. I took my nurse hat off and finally just became a mom.
Right.
Yeah.
I like that.
Yeah, he did tons of stuff in his life. My in-laws found out there's a horseback riding program for just people with disabilities in our province. So at 2, they're like, you need to sign them up. It's a 4-year wait list. So at 2 years old, I signed my son up for horseback riding. And when he was 6, we got the call. So he got to do horseback riding for 4 years, like spring and fall. They had a spring and fall session. And he would have a sidewalker on either side holding him on and a leader. And they did all kinds of like therapy games. I actually wonder if that's what ended up helping him learn to walk independently. Because it really strengthens the core.
Oh, it really does. Yeah.
Yeah.
He must have been one of the younger ones there if it was a 4-year waiting list.
Baby hair.
I was going to say, they must have loved having a 6-year-old. Like, who puts their 2-year-old on a waiting list for horseback riding? That's awesome. Yeah, that was perfect. That was perfect. Thank you, Grandma, Grandpa.
And a half. They had a spot open up and his name.
At 5 and a half?
He wasn't old enough yet, but he's like the they're like, well, we'll just we'll let him.
We're not gonna stick you on the bottom of the list again, that's for sure. Right.
I had the same sidewalker the whole 4 years. They developed such a neat bond.
Yeah.
Oh, they loved each other. But the neat thing about the horseback riding is every 5 years they would do some grand event to celebrate the organization. And so one year they had a big party, I don't know what you call it, at Lieutenant Governor's house in Winnipeg. So he got to, I always get that wrong. Maybe it's not the, I get Lieutenant Governor and Governor General mixed up. But anyway, it was some high up person.
Okay.
And it's this fancy house. And I dressed Jake up. Only 2 people could go. So it was just me and Jake. My husband stayed home. And I dressed him up in a suit. And I was in a dress. And everyone was, all these kids were there with disabilities and wheelchairs and shaking hands with these politicians. And there's fancy food. And Jake drags me all around that whole entire place, meeting everybody. I had to meet.
Right. Hi. And shaking hands. Right.
Shaking hands. And he loved, we found out probably then that he loved to dress up. When you put a suit on him, he normally was very smiley and kind of giggly. You put a suit on him and he'd sit up really straight in his wheelchair and he would get a serious look on his face, and we dressed him up for a couple of weddings in a suit, and his whole demeanor would change when you put a suit on him.
Very serious.
Yeah, very, very serious. Yeah, we teased him that he was bougie. Yeah.
Oh, I love that.
So he loved to dress up. Adventures. We just, I don't know. He was my only child, and I had time, and he didn't really ever love toys. He loved books, so his library is giant. Like, we have so many books. And that's a way that he and I would communicate a lot, is we would look at pictures, we'd read it, and he would get excited about something, and it would be an opportunity for us to talk about it.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, so books, but we were constantly driving to the city and going to find stuff to do. And the one thing I realized in hindsight, because he also yelled a lot on the way there, and I think I was actually stressing him out quite a bit, taking him to all these places. But I thought I was enriching his
Yeah.
life. So,
Oh. Well, you do the best you can, right?
yeah,
You do the
the
best
best.
we
Yeah,
can.
yeah, yeah, yeah. And then the other thing I think I mentioned I wanted to talk about today was kind of the point where I started seeing Jake as a full person, and that sounds weird. Like, I have been around people with disabilities a lot of my life. And so I actually, when he got his diagnosis, on one hand, I was like, well, I know how to do this. I've interacted with people with disabilities, like, and he's my kid, and it's just a whole different thing. But I didn't realize that unconsciously, and I think it's partly because, where we're at in society too. But unconsciously, I did have some biases about where he could go and what he could accomplish and what he was capable of. So I just really limited him a lot, not realizing, and I only know that now after, in hindsight. And what happened was, so one other gift we had was my sister was an education assistant. And so in the summers when the kids are off in school, she's also off. So she would be able to come and look after Jake in the summers while we were at work. And she would talk to Jake. So 12-year-old Jake, like he was 12. I was always protecting him and beating him and not expecting a lot of him. She made him help her clean. Sometimes I'd hear about it when I got home. Not that he was mad. Take him to a restaurant, and if he was kind of yelling or, just she had grown kids at this time, so she'd raised two teenagers, and she's like, that's not acceptable. We are going if you don't stop that. And like, she just held him accountable. And she's like, I she and he loved his cousins, loved, loved, loved his cousins. So she would talk about them, and she'd say, if your cousin did that, I would take him home anyway. It's just really interesting. I didn't do that for him. So it was neat to have that part of my village.
I think that's common, I have to say. That is a common thing that I see, because I see that a lot as a pediatrician, that parents, they get so used to their child and wanting to make things a little bit easier in some ways, they don't challenge them as much as they should. And sometimes they don't parent them in the way that they should. And sometimes I have to call them out on it. Like, she's manipulating you. Okay, we can't let her do that. This is not okay. So I'm glad your sister did that for you, because I think your sister did what I normally have to end up doing, is calling people out and saying, no, you can put those expectations up a little bit higher. So I love that.
She did. And my mom did the same. And I remember being like, trying to protect him, right? Like, no, he's
Yeah, I know. I know.
somewhere in there. I went to a lot of conferences, and somewhere in there I went to a conference about presumed competence. And it's the theory of that is just looking at your child as though they are capable and treating them as they're capable and talking to them as though they're capable. It was a real shocker to me to realize I wasn't treating him like a person who could reach his full potential. It was just so interesting. And so then I started talking to him differently, and I started seeing him differently. And I started seeing him as a developing teenager, the developing teenager that he was, and just realizing he probably had hopes and dreams and thoughts, because the disease itself, we don't know a lot about what those kiddos are thinking because they can't get it
They can't.
out, but it's in there and we look at them. I also read a book around that time called Ghost Boy, and this is a man who somewhere in his teens developed a viral disease that left him in a coma, and then he came to, but he was basically locked in for a couple of years. He developed awareness somewhere after 2 years, but nobody knew. So he, for most of his teenage life, being aware, but nobody treating him like he was aware. and eventually as an adult became able to communicate with technology and ended up writing this book.
Wow. Yeah.
And so as I read it from his perspective, it's like, oh my goodness, there is a lot of here. There's a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so his and my relationship changed dramatically from that experience. And we spent more time, we could look each other in the eyes, and I felt like we communicated at a deeper level. I finally got it. He's telling me all kinds of stuff. So it was a gift that I got to experience that with him. And he had probably a good 2 to 3 years of that before he did die. So the other thing about, so we also then really started pushing for, we tried a communication board on his iPad, and he just didn't have the dexterity. And so we finally started trying something called iGaze. And unfortunately, all of that started happening right during COVID stuff. So we didn't end up going as far with it as we could. He played some games on there to start like learning how to use his eyes to, play the game on the computer. He'd move things on, the computer with his eyes. And so eventually the next step would have been using his eyes to point to words and talk to us. And my dream for him was like, someday you're going to be able to communicate and either tell us, but maybe even write a book. Like,
yeah,
you never know.
Well, I had someone on the podcast whose daughter wrote a book with iGaze.
I remember that. I listened.
Yeah.
Yeah. Uh-huh. So that was my biggest dream for him. Parents do that all the time, project. But so I just felt like he was kind of at the prime of his life. And I will say, I say that at the same time, he was also starting to decline physically.
Yeah.
So he died at 15, but 3 years before he died is when we started noticing subtle. He lost his ability to walk. He lost his ability to use his signs. He lost his ability to like drink out of his cup on his own. So those things started. So physically he was declining, but cognitively like he was soaring. So I just felt like he was kind of at the prime of his life. And I knew with the decline from what I'd read, it would eventually plateau. So I was like, okay,
we'll see where it's going to plateau.
Mm-hmm. I'm grieving, but once you plateau, like, we're just going to live with this new normal and we're going to give you the tools. And so I'd come to this beautiful place.
Yeah. And you had expected it to go on for quite a bit longer, probably.
Yeah, I had. Yeah. Yes, I guess I didn't talk about that yet. But yeah, I had, by that time I had accepted Jake's life might be shortened.
Yeah.
But I truly thought he's doing pretty darn good. He's going to be one of the ones that lives into the 70s.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I had a whole future pictured.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that you would be with him until you were old. For sure.
Yes. Right? Oh, yeah. I pictured myself as 90 something.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Him and I still visiting and that.
Yeah.
I had a very different picture of his adult life.
So when did that change? When did you, was that something that slowly happened or?
Not really. It happened probably the week before he died.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
So his declines started a year before he died, but I wasn't seeing it.
Right.
And I know people on the outside were seeing it. And I know this because for instance, he died November 8th, and in Canada, our Thanksgiving's in October. And we had Thanksgiving at my parents' house. And I think I was told in hindsight, like afterwards, after he died, that my mom had said, you guys probably all should come home, like to my sisters and my niece and nephews. You should probably come for Thanksgiving. This might be Jake's last Thanksgiving.
Really?
Yeah.
And you didn't see it? No.
I think all I saw was he was declining and we were losing the Jake we had known.
Yeah.
And he lost his smile.
Yeah.
In the summer. That was the hardest.
Oh, for sure. Especially because he was such a smiley guy, right? So smiley, so friendly, so
So I arranged, we actually didn't take a lot of pictures because he was losing a lot of weight that year. And I knew he looked sick. So I actually stopped sharing on social media as much. I stopped sharing pictures. I stopped taking a lot of pictures because I think I was in denial, and or I thought this is his new normal. I was in very much in fix it mode. We're gonna fix this. Anyway, so I did arrange for us to have family pictures done in September because we were kind of avoiding it because we're like, well, he doesn't have a smile. Let's wait till he gets his smile back. And then I one day realized the smile's probably not coming back. So, and I had been following a lot of people on Instagram who really talked about, disability pride and not like stopping all this conditional, I love you if, or you're great if, that smile doesn't, I don't not love him because he can't smile. And I don't want to hide him from the world because he can't smile. And I felt like we needed to take those pictures to capture what we still have because we might be, I anticipated we might even lose more. Like I started picturing, okay, well, maybe he'll be like Stephen Hawking. Maybe he'll stop being able to use his body and he'll stop being able to eat on his own. I'm not sure if Stephen could eat or not, Stephen Hawking, but Stephen Hawking communicated with, technology. So, and he full career and, he full life. So that's was my new picture for Jake. And I'm very hopeful about that future and very accepting of that future. So I just, that was my new reality. That's what I thought. But what happened was the year before he died, it was kind of December-ish. He started throwing up. And so then we talked to his pediatrician and they ended up putting him on medication to help with acid reflux. It helped a bit, but then he was still throwing up at night. So we ended up putting him on twice a day and that helped. But he just wasn't eating as much and he was starting to choke a lot more. Like he did end up developing, like we had to puree or finally chop most of his foods. But yeah, so he had lost the ability to use his sippy cup by then. He started having to thicken his fluids. Like, so just kind of a slow progression. We started
Yeah, for
thickening
sure.
fluids. We started, making his food a little more puree, but he just kept losing weight. And so part of me was like, well, it's just because he doesn't have the motor skills anymore. He's losing that. So I started pureeing more. And then I started making more high fat foods to try and help him gain weight. He ended up needing, he was getting pressure injuries. So we needed to go to like a tilt wheelchair. And then he developed a movement disorder somewhere in April. We thought maybe it was seizures. And at this time, it's the middle of COVID. And so not everybody's seeing in person. So we did some phone over the phone stuff. And we did some videos to show them the seizure activity. And the neurologists weren't convinced, but like, I don't remember if we did a repeat EEG. Anyway, he did have some abnormalities on his EEG, but and seizures are a risk of sialic acid disease. Anyway, we did start him on some anti-seizure meds because he was getting really spastic and he would do these staring off episodes and he wouldn't be able to like, get him back kind of thing for a little while. So yeah, we started him on those medications and then again, just really losing weight. And then he started throwing up more often. He started getting constipated more often. And then in the summer, my sister was here looking after him. It's interesting. We moved to where we are now 3 years or about 3 years ago. And I was off for 9 months just to get him settled in. And we also knew in the back of our heads, he's declining need. So I took 9 months off when we moved here. But then his care started getting really hard. And also my employment insurance was going to run out. So like, okay, it's time to go back to work. I scheduled myself to go back to work July because I knew my sister was available to come out to help look after him. But his care was getting really hard. And I think in the back of my mind, I was actually going back to work in some ways to bring in the troops. Like, okay, I get respite then. And it helps sometimes when a caregiver outside of us comes in and sees things differently. And these aren't conscious thoughts I had, but like unconsciously, I wonder. And then she had a hard time caring for him on her own.
So that validated that a little bit in your head. You needed that, didn't you? Because you were like, is it just me or?
Yes.
Yeah. You did needed it, but you didn't want it in some ways, I'm sure.
Yeah. Like during that time, I will say I had intense grief. I think I knew what was happening because I would be in my closet on my knees crying. Like, yeah. Things weren't good.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, it was quite traumatizing for my sister.
Yeah.
To be in that situation, but he did end up actually going to hospital by ambulance once because he hit his head. He fell on a bed, and it's partly that movement disorder. And his pupils became fixed. I think one was like actually off to the side, and I was like, "Oh my gosh, headed."
Yeah.
We went in. We got a CT scan. Totally normal. Blood work. Totally normal. So we went home. He ended up then developing aspiration pneumonia. So
that was what happened the week before?
That was a different thing.
Okay.
Yeah. So sometime in the summer, we ended up in Children's Hospital, and he got a feeding tube put in. Because he had a feeding tube put in. It's so interesting that it's foggy to me because it used to be so clear. Anyway, he never did tolerate the feeding tube well. He was in constant discomfort, constant distress. And we tried, so we finally started to try a formula that had, it was all broken down completely. So, like, an formula of some sort.
Yeah.
And he still wasn't tolerating it. So the week before, what happened was he was in excruciating pain. I thought it was his movement disorder. By the way, they also did a repeat MRI, and it had shown decline in all the things in his brain. But they did say probably it's not seizures, it's probably a movement disorder, and it's just part of the brain, declining, basically.
Right.
And so it causes this movement disorder. It's involuntary movements. And it didn't sound like there's a lot we could do about it. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so anyway, one night, my husband's like, I'm sure it's pain. And I was like, nope, it's a movement disorder. You need to have these arguments all the time because I knew best. Yeah. But I didn't. Always. Often I didn't. So I sat up with him that night, and I decided to vent his tube and like just try and get as much air out as possible from his tummy. And he settled. Like, I think my husband's right. This is pain. This is stomach pain. Mm-hmm. So I made a pediatric appointment. We went the next day and kind of described everything that had been happening. By this time, we were having to give a lot of suppositories to help them have a bowel movement. Anyway, he sent him for x-rays, and then we were on our way home. And on our way home, Jake went stiff as a board and just so much pain, sweating, profuse sweating, so much discomfort. I started venting his tube again, like put a syringe in there to get the air out of his tummy, and turned around and went back to emerge. And then they did another x-ray. And meanwhile, the pediatrician had been trying to call us. I was ignoring the call because we were in emerge. Trying to track us down because the x-ray results showed an obstruction. So he had a bowel obstruction. And so he got put in hospital, IV fluids, no food. And he started doing pretty good. And then we tried feeding him. I think I went to work on a night shift. We tried feeding him. And then my husband sent me a picture with a machine, CPAP machine or BiPAP machine to help him breathe because he had just crashed on that, basically. And so then he stopped feeding again. And it sounds like he developed a pneumonia again. Because initially they had said, well, the obstruction's clear. But what they found is it wasn't poop that was clogging up his intestine. There was nothing in there. It was just not moving.
Just not moving.
Yeah.
Yeah. And there's really not a whole lot to be able to do then.
Yeah. And thank you for saying that, because I often wonder, like, should we have done intravenous nutrition?
Yeah, right.
But in the meantime, his pulse in the hospital was 30, in the 30s. Oh. And so he was getting IV fluids. And so we're still in fix-it mode. And I think I finally called palliative care at our children's hospital. Because in the summer when he got the tube, they had, I wanted to find, like, talk about what are we doing? What are the goals? And they brought him palliative care. And they said, we're not here because he's dying necessarily. We're here because he's complex. And we're here we're the people you would call if you just don't know what else to do. If you have questions, you're not sure where to go. So I called him because he also had a day, but I think we tried feeding him again, and he was in massive distress, writhing around in the bed. It took forever for the pediatrician to come because he must have been involved with some other really urgent stuff. But so for like hours, we're watching him just sweating, and like it was just horrible. It was so distressing. Anyway, we were talking about it. We're still in fix him. When I was talking to, like, well, what about all this stuff that's been happening for the last year? And he's like, well, let's get control of what's going on now. But I was just really like, we've got to talk about what's happening here. There's something bigger. And so I finally called palliative care, and I described the last year, and they said, I think he's at end of life. Just very matter of fact, very blunt, also very refreshing. Just to let's talk honestly. Very, very
His,
hard to hear.
yeah,
But
but his body was just tired.
yeah, this body. And so I think it was a relief for our pediatrician that we did that, because then we were communicated with them that we talked to palliative care, and it sounds like he's at end of life. And then they didn't have to have that conversation.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, my husband wasn't there though when I made that call. And so I was like, what do you tell your husband about your dying child? He doesn't know he's dying. At this point, my husband was still really pushing to, like, let's feed him. We got to get him home. Let's feed him.
Yeah,
Let's
right.
get him fixed. And so
Yeah.
he had, like, I think my gut, I kind of knew things weren't going to be going very well, but my husband had no clue. It was completely, completely, like,
Yeah.
yeah.
Well, 'cause you just keep doing it. You just keep doing what you've been doing. And he's 15 at this point, right? So you have been doing this for 15 years, and he just keeps going. And I think you can not let yourself believe that that it'll end, because the outcome is always the same, that it always just keeps going. So this time it's just different.
Yeah, it was just different. So yeah, the hardest thing I've ever had to do probably was ask my husband to come from work and tell him that Jake was dying. I'd wanted to do it with palliative care on the phone, but he got there and they weren't quite available yet. They were available within minutes, but like, when you tell your husband and you call him from work and he's like, what? Like, what? So they gave us a private room to talk in, and so the other interesting thing was his pulse being in the 30s. I'm like, I know that's not good. Like, I was talking to the pediatrician. I'm like, so tell me a bit about like what's happening with this. Like, it's in the 30s. He's like, yeah, that's not really compatible with life. And I said, I know. So how come he's still here? He said, well, he's got IV fluids going, so it's keeping the volume up enough for him to be able to keep going. So I said, so once we stop the IV fluids, like, that's things he won't be able to live, And so I just had a feeling that it was like a Wednesday or Thursday. We had a meeting to talk about discharge, so we got to take Jake home. And we had said in the meeting, or I had said, I asked all my family if they wanted to come to see Jake, that they probably should do it this weekend because I don't think he's going to last till next weekend. And they actually didn't really think it would go that quickly. But yeah, he died on Sunday night. We went home Friday, I think, and he died on Sunday night. Those IV fluids, that's really all that was keeping him alive. The other thing that happened too was because we basically had a week with him in the hospital with not eating. And it was the first time in probably 6 months to a year where we'd seen him so calm and so comfortable. It was probably the best quality of life he'd had in a lot of months.
Wow.
Yeah, he'd had that last year was really hard for him and for us. Yeah,
Sounds like it.
so it felt like a gift to him to be able to just let him go, as hard as it was for us.
That's what I was going to say. As hard as it was for us, it was a gift for him in some ways.
Yeah.
So talk about your grief journey a little bit since then.
Oh gosh. First off, I was shocked that I wasn't in bed under the covers, not able to get up. It was shocking to me that I could get up and put my one foot in front of the other every day.
I know.
Yeah. It was so surreal.
It's funny because you just don't think you can.
Yeah.
And yeah, I know.
We didn't do much else. We promised ourselves we would shower once every day and we would get out of bed every day, even if we went right back into bed.
Okay.
And we did a lot of talking. We did a lot of crying. Planning his funeral was quite touching.
Yeah.
Because he had such an amazing life. So to be able to celebrate that and honor him and share. Because he had a disability and he didn't have a lot of words. I don't like using the word nonverbal. So, but people didn't know him in the deep way that we knew him.
Sure.
Some people did, but a lot of people didn't. And I just really, really wanted people to know him. I think we accomplished that.
Yeah.
This funeral. Yeah. We had it. We had a lot of support. It was also, though, it's just such an isolating time. It's so interesting. Even though people reach out and people are there, it's just, yeah. I don't know. I took 3 months off work. It doesn't seem like a lot. In hindsight, it probably should have taken longer. My husband took 2 months. I was just having a hard time being at home every day, all day.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
And I was going back to work half time. That was my like position. And so I also knew that I was going to have days off in between to kind of do the grief work. Yeah.
And I think that's important to be able to know that you can do that.
Yeah. Yeah. It was still hard. I will say I was very wrapped up in my grief, which is normal. I'm very wrapped up in my grief. I did a lot of, now I guess we're just over 2 years now since he's died. I did a lot of judging of myself and my grief and how I should be doing it and what it's supposed to look like.
Yeah.
I tried counseling for the first little while and it didn't really feel like it was hitting the mark.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I listened to a lot of podcasts. I finally found yours, which I think I just found yours about a year ago. I did a lot of reading. I have a very large library of, again, that analytical brain, just trying to figure out grief and what I'm supposed to do, and doesn't help.
No. I mean, yes and no, right? Yes and no.
I understand.
I think what helps is that knowing that there isn't exactly a right way or a wrong way. I think that is helpful to learn that, because it sounds like you were doing what Gwen always says that you can't do, is you don't should on yourself, right? So you are should, I should be doing this, I should be doing that. So hopefully what you could learn is to stop doing that.
Yeah.
And there isn't a should.
Yeah. And I was, because I was judging myself for my grief, I was making an assumption that everybody else around me was judging
me. Yes.
My grief.
Yes. And even so, when they might not be.
Totally. Any little subtle thing. And I would be like, oh, no, they're judging. And I would just shut down or I would close them off. I pushed a lot of people away. It's interesting because on one hand, I was like, I thought people would call me all the time. And I thought they would always be like, you know, I thought we were close. On the other hand, if they tried to reach out, I pushed them away. Like,
right.
And it's interesting because I have just started going back to counseling about 2 or 3 months ago. And I specifically this time asked for someone who specializes in grief, which
right.
makes all
it makes all the difference in the world.
Yes.
All the difference in the world. A lot of people really don't know how to counsel people who are grieving. I mean, they just don't.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. And at first, well, it's interesting. So the biggest insight I had with her was because I kept kind of talking about people not being there. And knowing in my brain, people have very much tried to be there. Like, I know they have.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so there's one thing I realized, and I now communicated with my support circle, is because they may have felt like maybe they weren't saying the right thing, or they weren't saying enough. And I finally came to the realization, it didn't matter what you said or did or didn't do. It was never going to be enough, because what I needed you to do is bring back Jake.
Yeah.
And you couldn't. And no one could. So, you know, there's that anger.
Yeah. And I think you're right that, I mean, I think of myself, I don't have the same friends I did. I don't. And a lot of those friendships have really fallen away. But a lot of that is my fault. It's not all their fault. I mean, sometimes I think they're just not comfortable in it. And so they pull away a little bit. But I let them.
Yeah.
I let them too.
Well, and I kept talking to my counselor about, it's not safe to talk to them. They're not safe. They're not safe. And or they can't handle it, or they can't. She's like, you are making things mean something they don't necessarily mean. Like, you're like, you don't necessarily know that. Like, I'm sitting.
Right.
And then she said, the one thing that's really made my grief shift is when your child dies, you're living in a world where your child is not supposed to die. It's not supposed to happen.
Right.
And when your child dies, it becomes an unsafe world.
Yes.
So, of course, nothing is safe. You're now in a world where nothing feels safe anymore. Mm-hmm. So now even talking about your feelings to friends that or family should feel safe, even if they have given you no indication that they're unsafe to talk to, it's not going to feel safe because nothing feels safe anymore.
Right.
And right. It was the biggest aha moment. I was like, okay, they're actually.
That is a huge moment. Yeah.
Yeah. And so ever since then, I've actually finally started opening up a little bit more. So it's what, 2 years. It's over 2 years and I'm finally sharing my feeling. I've done a lot of private grieving, a lot of crying on my own. My husband and I grieve a lot together as well. But just not letting people in. I did a blog for a little while and I would share my writing, but it's not the same as just having people hold space for you, and well, they don't know how to hold space.
And allowing people to hold space for you.
And allowing. So it's a vulnerable thing, and I've come a long way. Yeah. It's interesting because, of course, it ebbs and flows. So right now I'm in a really good space, but I'm also doing a really intense course right now, along with working full time. And that's what I do. I use distraction. Mm-hmm. I've done it. I did it when Jake was diagnosed. I did it when I was struggling with his disability, and I'm doing it now. I work, so I have to really be conscious of that and make sure I'm taking time to.
But I think that's okay. I mean, it's not like necessarily a bad thing that you use that, because your mind can't handle the grief all the time. But as long as you are intentional about setting time aside to do your grief work, that's what's important.
Yeah.
Right. And as long as you continue to do that and you don't let those other things be all consuming and leave you no time to grieve, because that's when you get in trouble.
Yeah. I would agree. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, yeah. And so his death anniversary was in November. I really struggled from November pretty much all the way through January. His birthday's in January. I am definitely finding my grief was intense and acute, and I cried a lot in the first year, especially the first few months. But now it's affecting, like, it is hard to get out of bed. Like, it's funny, when you first died, it wasn't hard to get out of bed. Well, now it's like almost every day I wake up and like, I don't know if I can do this today. And then I do, I put one step foot in front of the other and I do it. Mm-hmm. But it's so heavy. It's so heavy. Yeah. And I have definitely had been trying to figure out like ways to do more intentional grief work this last couple months.
And then you emailed me.
Yeah.
Because this is very intentional grief work.
Yeah.
What you're doing here and sharing this story here.
Uh-huh. Yeah. I was just,
As I'm listening to you talk, I'm like, oh, and this is part of it. This is a little healing part of it for you.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I love that.
Yeah. Well, and I've been going through a lot of the, is there something else I could have done?
And there isn't.
Yeah. And thank you. For a little while, I was like, I know there's nothing else, but you just wonder, like, what else? What else? Did I miss something?
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for coming on and sharing Jake with us today. I just loved learning about him. Yes. And I hope this is a good part of your healing journey.
It is. Yeah, I really enjoyed talking about my guy.
About your guy.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you. It was so nice to meet you.
Thanks for listening. If you found this helpful and would like to support the podcast, please leave a 5-star rating and comment. To help financially, you can type Andy's Mom, one word, to the number 53555. This provides a link to GiveButter, which allows donations through PayPal, Venmo, Apple Pay, or credit cards. GiveButter will provide a receipt of your tax-deductible donation. Or you can visit the donation page at andysmom.com/donate. Always Andy's Mom is a registered 501c3 and can receive donations through Thrivent Financial and Benevity. Marcy loves hearing from listeners. Please feel free to reach out to her via email at marcy@andysmom.com or on the Instagram or Facebook Always Andy's Mom accounts. Sign up for the email list to get weekly episode links as well as pictures of Marcy's guests and their children. Together, let's work to inspire hope one day at a time.